almost every Fair Tax event, hosting training sessions for local volunteers and asking anybody who will listen to help buy radio and print ads for the Fair Tax and to help build citizen armies necessary to win on the issue. Marilyn Rickert, Oak Forest, Illinois, discovered the Fair Tax at the same time she discovered the Internet while healing from a broken leg in 1996. Skeptical at first, but the more she learned, the more she believed, and now she's an active and dynamic citizen voice for the Fair Tax. She organizes, writes, and talks to everyone she can to advance the cause. Phil Hinson in Georgia traveled far and wide to support the Fair Tax for years. More people have heard Phil speak on the Fair Tax than almost any other speaker. He's been invited to speak to groups wanting to learn more about the Fair Tax throughout the Southeast, and he brings his passion to his own Fair Tax radio show in Atlanta. A thoughtful student of the Fair Tax and its promise for America, Phil often posts his insights on the Internet as podcasts. Roger Buchholz, Kalamazoo, Michigan. He has led an effort to develop a statewide Fair Tax organization complete with media spokespeople. He makes frequent appearances on radio shows, leads grassroots organizing by congressional districts. Michigan is now considering a Fair Tax system at the state level, largely because of Roger's work. When Bill Spillane in California first heard about the Fair Tax on a radio ad in 1997, he knew his previous work to eliminate the corporate income tax, recognized by President Reagan, had been child's play, in his words, compared to the beneficial effects of the Fair Tax. A former fighter jock and commercial airline pilot, Bill believes strongly that Made in America label will come roaring back to life with the passage of the Fair Tax, and he works tirelessly to advance the cause. John Collette in Kansas. He worked all over the Midwest for years to bring the Fair Tax message to American farmers. He led the effort to bring along the American Farm Bureau, going from county to county to explain the advantages to farmers of eliminating the inheritance tax, eliminating embedded taxes from the cost of farm equipment prices, and putting American commodities on a level playing field with foreign crops sold here and abroad. And last, but definitely not least, we want to recognize those of you who have written letters to the editors of your local newspapers around the nation. You all deserve a very special mention for the impact you've had. Though your faces are unknown to us, your words and passion are bringing the Fair Tax closer to reality. Brad Hill wrote to the Lancaster Eagle Gazette in Ohio to explain the benefits of the Fair Tax for small business people. Hugh Williams wrote to the Omaha World Herald. This has been going on all over the country. So, as they say, thank you for your cards and letters. We'd mention plenty more names if our publisher would only spring for the paper. If you demand a Fair Tax Volume 3, we'll pick up where we left off, but our real point is that the Fair Tax isn't just AFFT, and it definitely isn't just us. It's the collective effort of millions, and it is vibrant and alive. A movement this large can never stay alive on the backs of a small team. It must be buoyed by individuals who feel called to dedicate their time and resources to it. The Fair Tax is just such a phenomenon, and we're grateful to all who participate. Okay, the next chapter, chapter 12, is our vision for tomorrow. You've read the Fair Tax book, at least we hope you have, and now you're near the end of listening to the Fair Tax, the truth. With luck, you're convinced. If you are, we're glad. If you're not, well, then please tell us what we need to do. You want us to come have dinner with you at your home? Take you out to dinner to Ryan's? We'll even let your kids go. What's it going to take? Look, we've handled pretty much every substantial objection that's ever been thrown at the Fair Tax. We even took the time to respond to that Scientology nonsense. Of course, that doesn't mean that we've dealt with every single objection, just the ones that seem relatively well thought out and have been presented with some degree of earnestness. We more or less ignored, for instance, the claim that we're interested in the Fair Tax because we're rich and we want to get out of paying income taxes. All right, we mentioned it once, it got under our skin. We could spend more time trying to explain the difference between taxing wealth and taxing income, but what good would that do? Besides, we're both close enough to retirement that soon we're not going to be paying income taxes anyway. No, we'd much rather spend our time on one last effort to convince you to climb aboard the fair tax bandwagon, to put aside all but the most basic life-sustaining functions and become a volunteer for the fair tax. We're going to ask you to crank up your imagination for a moment here, and by you, we mean those of you who think that the fair tax is a bad idea. Just a little mental exercise. Drop all of your preconceptions for just a moment, and we want to paint a scenario for you to consider. We want you to try to picture life under the fair tax. Just imagine, for your entire life, you have been living and working in a United States where the federal government is funded by the fair tax, not by an income tax. For the moment, forget all your misgivings about whether the fair tax will really work. Just sit back and let us tell you how your day-to-day life would be under the fair tax. Here would be the basic economic framework of your life. Every payday, you've been getting your complete paycheck. No deductions, no withholding for income tax, Social Security tax, Medicare tax. If you earn $2,000 per week, you've been getting a check for $4,000 every other Friday. There have been no distinctions between what you earn and your take-home pay. Throughout your work life, whenever you earned a raise or changed jobs for more pay, you never, ever had to try to figure out how much of that raise or how much of your new paycheck you were going to be able to keep. A $5,200 a year raise has always meant for you an extra $200 in your paycheck every other week. You have never had to save receipts or create any records pertaining to federal taxes. The only receipt you need to keep is the one for that ugly dress your husband bought for you so that you can return it when he's not looking. You've always been able to invest what you earn without first having to pay any federal taxes on it. Every time you've had money left over at the end of the month, you've been able to put that money into a savings account or other investment. That money has never been taxed. The interest on it has never been taxed, and it will never be taxed. When your parents died, they were able to leave you everything they had, just as their parents did for them. There were no taxes. And you know that you will be able to leave whatever you have earned and accumulate to whoever you wish when you take the eternal celestial dirt nap without any tax consequences. You will never know the death of a loved one to be a taxable event. All your life, every time you have gone to the store to buy an item and the price tag read $19.99, you handed a $20 bill to the cashier and you got a penny as change. All your life, the price tag on the item was the price you paid at the cash register. The tax man took his 23% out of that purchase price. The only annoying thing about this whole affair is that stupid little trick of trying to make something seem cheaper by lopping 1 cent off the price and calling it $19.99. All your life, there have been four people in your household, you, your spouse, and two rugrats. At the beginning of every month, you've been getting a credit to your checking or savings account in the amount of $506 to compensate you for the federal taxes that were included in the price of everything that you bought during that month, right up to the poverty level. This has ensured that you have always been able to purchase the basic necessities for your family without paying any tax whatsoever to the federal government. For you, paying taxes to the federal government has always been voluntary. You've saved your money after providing the basics to your family, and you haven't been taxed. You spent your money, and you were. It was always your choice. You have never had to fill out a federal tax return. You have never received a letter from the Internal Revenue Service. For all you know, IRS agents work for the Iowa Railroad System. Your bank has never made a report to the federal government on your deposit or withdrawal habits, either with or without your knowledge. The federal government has never gone to your bank secretly to poke through your statements and your accounts for the past 7 years. Though you have never heard of anything called the alternative minimum tax, the very sound of that phrase is unsettling to you. You've never had to hide under your bed to avoid getting a good job. The American economy has always been strong. You've never heard of a politician in Washington trying to use the federal tax code to control your behavior in any way. And the 15th day of April has always, for you, been just another spring day, unless you live in the Southern Hemisphere. Now, does that sound like such a bad life? You've kept all the money you've earned. You've been getting $500 a month from the feds, and you only paid taxes when you spent money. Does that sound like such a bad deal? Okay, in our little imaginary world, we've now established your economic situation. So, along comes a congressman who has a brand new tax scheme, a brand new tax system. He thinks he can improve on the fair tax you've been living with all your life. Now, the true purpose of this politician's proposed new tax code is to take more of your power over your economic life and transfer that power to Washington. This politician gets together with some D.C. power brokers and comes up with the grand idea. Before it can become the new law of the land, though, he has to explain it to you and get your support. After all, it's going to take a constitutional amendment to get this done. So here you are, living with the fair tax all your life, and here comes this politician with this great, wonderful idea. The first thing he tells you is that he's going to eliminate the fair tax. That's right. He's going to take the fair tax off of everything you buy. And that will mean that everything is going to cost 23% less than it does right now. Already, you're interested. But put down the champagne, Charlie. It ain't what it seems. The next step in this politician's grand plan is to have the federal government tax every single penny you earn. Now, you're a pretty successful kind of person, and this new tax plan is going to tax you based on how successful you are at making money. But hey, you might think it's perfectly fine for you to pay more taxes if you earn more money. After all, that's more or less the way it's been since you drew your first paycheck. The more you earned, the more you spent, and the more you spent, the more taxes you paid, the more fair taxes you paid. Well, your politician friend has a bit of a twist for you. Sure, you're going to pay more income tax as your income goes up, but here's the surprise. The more successful you are, the higher the income tax rate is going to be. Oh, you want details? Fine. For some reason, this politician is a little reluctant to offer any specifics, but we've managed to look into a crystal ball and copy down the figures. As you absorb them, remember, up until now, all you've ever done is pay the federal government 23 cents of every dollar you spent. You've never paid anything on any money you've invested or saved. So under this new plan they're trying to sell you, here's what you'd pay. 10% of every dollar of income less than $15,650. 15% on every dollar of income up to about $63,000. Then 25% on every additional dollar of income up to about $130,000. Then 28% on every dollar of income up to about $200,000. Okay. Then 33% on every dollar of income up to about $350,000. And then above that, 35%. Now let's assume you're in a middle income bracket. How does this new plan sound? You used to pay a 23% inclusive sales tax on purchases. Now you'll have to pay 25%, not just on what you spend, but on everything you earn. And the more you earn, the worse it gets. How is this guy's tax plan sounding to you now? What's more, not only will you be taxed, but so will every individual in every business that plays any role at all in bringing every single product you buy and every single service you use to the marketplace. Now, you can rest assured that these businesses and individuals aren't going to take these new federal taxes laying down. To them, the new federal taxes will be just another cost of doing business, and like the other business cost, they're going to be factored into the cost of whatever they produce. Those taxes are going to end up embedded in the prices of products at the retail marketplace. So there goes that 23% break in prices you thought you were going to get. Wait, there's more. Next, this politician is proposing taking away your $500 per month sales tax prebate. Sure, you'll get some tax deductions under the plan, but those deductions won't come anywhere close to the prebate you've been receiving all your working life. Finally, if you're not already dancing in the aisles over the prospect of this great new tax plan, there's one more detail he forgot to mention, a nifty little thing called payroll taxes. All your life, Social Security and Medicare have been funded by the federal revenues generated by the fair tax, but the rates your politician is proposing for the new federal income tax won't cover that, so they're going to have to get you to pay for them separately. First, let's take Social Security. Your employer is going to start deducting 6.2% from every one of your paychecks. It's going to be called a contribution, but there is nothing voluntary about it. Then your employer is going to have to match that contribution with another 6.2%. Now, you're smarter than that, aren't you? You realize that your employer is not going to swallow that 6.2%. Either it's going to come out of your next pay raise, so good luck on that for a while, or it's going to go into the price of whatever you're making and selling. And, of course, if you were to change jobs under the grand new plan, any new salary would be reduced by the employer's increased cost for this matching contribution nonsense. Medicare? Nope. The income tax revenues won't cover that either. Just as you did with Social Security, you're going to get nailed with another new tax to cover Medicare. How much? Well, the new plan is going to use that same matching contribution idea, so you'll end up paying another 2.9% of everything you earn. Are you adding all this up? 25% on your income for income taxes, Social Security, Medicare. We're in the 40% range. And remember, right now, you're only paying 23% on everything you spend at the poverty level. Come on, folks, be serious. How in the world is any politician going to be able to sell that ridiculous idea to you? But wait, we're not through. There are still some more facets to this great new tax plan. Do you have any investments? You've always been able to invest with absolutely no tax consequences. If this new tax idea becomes law, though, not only will you have to give the government a share of your earnings before you can invest them, you'll also have to pay the government on any money you earn. It's going to be called a capital gains tax. What the government is really talking about is a tax on capitalism. Then we're going to have a death tax. Isn't that just great? When you die, your family will have to file a complicated estate tax return. A huge amount of the wealth you've managed to build during your life will be sent to the government. Your survivors may well have to sell the family business in order to come up with the money to pay for these death taxes. And then we have a few procedural details to deal with. You'll have to start keeping records on all your financial transactions. Every year, you'll have to spend about 30 hours filling out tax forms or hundreds of dollars to hire somebody to fill them out for you. Trillions of dollars will leave the American economy to work in foreign markets where the tax treatment will be better. Billions more will be spent by businesses and individuals in this country to cover the cost of compliance with the new tax scheme. If you make mistakes on these new federal tax forms you have to fill out, you could be hit with a big penalty in interest. You could even go to jail. The government is going to have access to all your financial records to make sure you're paying what some politicians have decided is your fair share. And then politicians will soon learn that they can curry favor with voters by pandering to their jealousies and raising taxes on the evil rich. And if you work hard, that means you. Thousands of people are going to start earning big bucks inside the Beltway, lobbying members of Congress for favorable tax treatment for their clients. And America will no longer be the world's number one tax haven. businesses will pack up and leave in search of a new home where they can do business without a tax component on capital and labor. One of the jobs lost could be yours. But wait, you say, why in the world would any politician want to change the tax system that way? Why is he trying so hard, spending so much money to convince me that this new system will be better for you, for me, for the rest of the country than the simple national retail sales tax you've been paying your whole life? Answer, one word, power. The more politicians can control your access to your own wealth and your earnings, the more powerful they are. The more politicians can affect businesses and important business decisions with tax policy, the more powerful they are. The more they can adversely affect the financial picture of one segment of our economy for the benefit of another, the more powerful they are. The more politicians can pander to the petty fears and jealousies of people by punishing high achievers for their efforts, the more powerful they are. Under the fair tax, these politicians have had no power to use the tax policy to favor one group of voters over another. Bring in the new income tax scheme, and wonderful new horizons for manipulation and power brokering open up for any politician who would like to use it. And what politician wouldn't? So there, with any luck, if you played along, this exercise has given you something of a new perspective on the fair tax and its benefits. Is it perfect? No. But on the other hand, think about what you've just heard. If you lived under the fair tax now, would you be willing to switch back to our current system? If you really think you would opt for this system after having lived under the fair tax virtually all your life, you might want to have your drinking water checked for hallucinogens. Of course, after years of research, the development of a 133-page bill, and years of close examination and critique, we believe the fair tax should be passed as is. At the same time, through the years, we've heard some very interesting and valuable recommendations for improving it. For example, some people have suggested that the act could be made contingent on the repeal of the 16th Amendment, the 1913 amendment that created the current income tax. Others have weighed the wisdom of adding a provision that a supermajority should be required to exempt or exclude any good or service. Neither of these provisions is in the bill right now, but they're certainly being considered. Some have suggested that we have a lower rate on sales and a small tax on the incomes of wealthy income earners. This is where we draw the line. Our current income tax began as a flat tax on high-income earners. It was flattened again in 86. It was amended 16,000 times. Every nation that starts out with a little of each has wound up with a lot of both. And our position is clear, one or the other, not both. If we go back to the principles that the tax code must be simple, fair, voluntary, transparent, border neutral, and industry neutral, as well as strengthen our retirement programs, and we manage to pass legislation that accomplishes these goals, we will have succeeded. Our vision for tomorrow is an America in which every American, including you, can be a voluntary taxpayer, paying taxes when you choose, as much as you choose, according to how much you spend. Our vision for tomorrow is an America where an individual driven to achieve and excel through hard work is not punished by a tax system that singles him out for mountains of record-keeping and paperwork, all leading to a punitive increase in his taxes. Our vision for tomorrow is an America with a tax system that can be used to spread freedom across the world. Under the fair tax vision for tomorrow, every time an American buys a loaf of bread or a new car, he'll know to the penny how much of that money is going to the federal government. Our vision for tomorrow sees a government that is a partner with the business community and the people, not an adversary, a government with a tax system that encourages economic development and the creation of new business, rather than a government and a tax system that chases valued business to foreign shores. Our vision for tomorrow is one where governance returns to the local level, where communities are allowed to make important decisions regarding their government and their schools. No longer will politicians be able to hide regulations and programs that control every aspect of our lives in 9 million words of confusing and draconian codes and regulations. The fair tax will demand political honesty. If Congress decides to come up with a new program or to expand a current program, that program will show up on the spending side of the ledger for you and other citizens to see. It's called transparency. And with the fair tax, with the beautiful simplicity of a tax system based on consumption spending, you'll be better equipped to hold your elected officials accountable for the decisions they make to expand the cost and the scope of government. Good for you? Sure. For people wanting your votes? A little tougher for them. Today, most Americans don't think twice about government spending. Why? Well, maybe because they're somehow convinced that somebody else is really paying for it. This is especially true for the bottom 50% of our income earners who pay no income taxes and are disproportionately beneficiaries of government spending. It's also true for the vast majority of our retired citizens. Under the fair tax, nobody would pay federal taxes on the basic necessities of life, but when you make the choice to spend beyond those necessities, you're taxed. Whether you are poor or retired, you will pay the tax on all spending above the poverty level. With more people actively participating and funding our government, more people will want to pay attention to how the money is spent. As we said, good for you, maybe not good for the politicians. Our vision for tomorrow sees an America where jobs are insourced, not outsourced. As you heard, former Secretary of Treasury John Snow called it the biggest magnet for capital and jobs in history. We will welcome legal immigrants to our country to do these jobs. Not only will they contribute tax dollars to our government every time they buy a loaf of bread, but they'll have an incentive to come here legally and get in line to become citizens. Under the fair tax, you see, only legal residents will escape taxation on the basic necessities. Prospective citizens will have a sense of ownership in the future of our country and will be just as interested as you are in throwing out the illegals who come here to take advantage of government-funded largesse or who get involved in criminal activity. Our vision for tomorrow sees America becoming the safest and most secure tax haven for trillions of dollars currently languishing offshore. When these dollars return to our markets, your and your neighbor's nest eggs will grow dramatically. The capital infusion will create more jobs and more consumption, and revenues will help compensate for the growth of our entitlement programs. It will also reduce interest rates for all borrowers. Our vision for tomorrow sees an America that will enjoy a virtual $400 billion per year tax cut. This is a good estimate of the amount of money that individuals and businesses now spend every year simply to figure out and obey our current tax code. With the tax code abolished and the collection process simplified, this money will stay in our pockets where it can work for economic growth. It will no longer be spent to feed the federal bureaucracy. Our vision for tomorrow sees America becoming an exporting powerhouse, selling goods and services into a global economy unburdened by the 22% tax component now burdening our price system. Our balances of trade and payments will improve because of it. Other nations' sales to Americans will face the same tax treatment as our sales to their citizens have faced for decades. Our imports will no longer have an advantage at the checkout counter over domestically produced products. Our vision for tomorrow sees an America where nobody will be able to live under the radar. Beneficiaries of illicit money and illegal labor will pay their share of our government burden each and every time they buy a car or a loaf of bread. Perhaps our most exciting vision for tomorrow is that our grandchildren will keep what they earn. They will not face a doubling of the payroll tax on every dollar they earn to pay for retirement benefits. Their interest rates will be lower, their homes and cars more affordable, and their savings won't be penalized. so saving for their children's education and their own retirement will be easier. Are these grandiose ideas? Yeah, perhaps, but we don't consider them pipe dreams. We are confident that the economic revolution that would result from the fair tax and the attendant transfer of power from the federal government to the people would bring our vision for tomorrow to life, and we're not alone. Millions of Americans, from presidential candidates to renowned economists to union members, see the opportunities that await us as well. Isn't this what life is all about? Don't we spend our lives trying to create a future for our children and grandchildren that's better than the world our parents left to us? We believe that our current tax code, which punishes initiative and thrift and rewards consumption, should be reversed so that our children will have incentives to produce and invest and save and thrive. Now we're dealing with the appendix of the book, The President's Advisory Panel on Tax Reform, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. In telling the full story of the fair tax, we're sadly forced to include a group formally known as the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform, which President Bush appointed in early 2005. We say sadly because an issue as large and complex as tax reform requires presidential leadership, and President Bush had a very real opportunity to be a leader on tax reform. But instead of providing that leadership, and counter to the counsel of many members of Congress, the president appointed a panel to study the tax issue and make recommendations to him for reform, and then hamstrung them. For those of you who wonder exactly what the president's advisory panel is and the work it did, you're not alone. And that's a primary reason to consider the panel's effort a failure. In its final report, the panel stated that its goal was to give voice to the frustrated American taxpayer and to provide a blueprint for lasting reform. Well, hoo-wah. That's an admirable goal that we all share, but by all accounts, not a single taxpayer found his or her voice in the report. Its recommendations didn't last past the news cycle of the day of its release. It was a complete failure by the panel's own yardstick. Though it must be said very loudly, blame for that failure rests not with the panel's member, but with the structure of the panel and the charge. Let's find out why. The tax panel was composed of some very bright minds on both the left and the right of the political and economic spectrum, and it worked ferociously and collaboratively to produce its report on time as instructed. But the panel was forced to work within some very specific constraints put on it by President Bush, and it was these restraints and the limitations of a committee structure in general that doomed the effort. Those of you who have served on panels or committees at your business, social club, neighborhood association, church, synagogue, Boy Scouts, or mosque know exactly what committees can do well and what they can't. Committees are very good at providing consensus solutions, strategies that blend together many divergent views and that everyone can tolerate. They're not good at providing leadership on controversial issues. It was no surprise then that the president's panel was very successful at the former and a complete failure at the latter. The panel's charge is often overlooked by those who comment on its work, but understanding the charge is critical to understanding the panel's report. The charge came in the form of Executive Order 13369, issued January 7, 2005. Now, part of that order charged the panel as follows. 1. It was to produce a report not for the president, but for the Secretary of the Treasury. 2. The report should be based on revenue-neutral tax policy. 3. The report should include options that A. simplify the tax code to reduce administrative cost and burdens, B. share tax benefits and burdens in an appropriately progressive manner, C. recognize the importance of home ownership and charitable giving, D. promote economic growth and job creation, E. encourage work, savings, investment, and global competitiveness. Then number four, the report should include at least one option that maintains the federal income tax. And five, the report was to be produced as soon as possible. If you're wondering why true tax reformers were opposed to the president creating this panel at the time, we think the language of the executive order makes it obvious. It is as if the president had been telling the panel and the nation, "My bold reform charge is to create a brand new tax system for America, brand new except that it should keep the progressive income tax as its base, and it should keep current popular tax deductions, and it should keep the current distribution of tax benefits and burdens, and it should keep current levels of tax revenues, but other than that, it should be new, simpler, and better than what we have today." The tax panel included some of the best minds in the business. But how much could it really do when keep everything the way it is but make it better was the mandate? This is the definition of tinkering with the tax code, and it has no possibility of providing a fundamental economic restructuring that we need. You don't develop a plan for fundamental reform without clear authority to tear up and throw away everything that has come before. Well, skip forward 11 months and two president-mandated extensions to the report date, and we find that the panel members did absolutely everything they could to inject some creativity into their very narrow mandate. The panel offered not one but two tax reform proposals for the president, rather for the Secretary of the Treasury to consider. The report adhered to all of the president's restrictive guidelines, as well as the panel's self-imposed guideline of unanimity in its decisions and recommendations. Unfortunately, almost by definition, unanimity and leadership are opposites. They're not synonyms. Even so, even with the keep everything the same mandate and the decision to require unanimity of the diverse panel members, these consensus recommendations were attacked by every interest group benefiting from special tax preferences that would not have been renewed. Further, as a consensus and compromise product, the panel's report had no primary sponsor to advocate for it. The panel's report was placed on a shelf at the Treasury Department's, and it has never been seen again. The report was delivered in November of 2005, and as we screamed by November of 2007, we couldn't find a single bill or proposal to come out of the White House or from the Capitol that codifies any of the recommendations in the report. To the panel that labored to fulfill President Bush's restrictive charge and sought to give voice to the frustrated American taxpayer and to provide a blueprint for lasting reform, this silence represents both frustration and failure, and the panel members haven't been afraid to share their frustration and disappointment about it. If the panel's report was shelved at the Treasury Department, why are we spending so much time on it here? The answer is that even though the panel's recommendations, found in chapters 5, 6, and 7 of the report, haven't received much airplay, the commentary on a national retail sales tax found in its chapter 9 has found a welcoming audience in fair tax opponents. Even though the chapter dealt primarily with traditional sales taxes and largely avoided the fair tax, our opponents still love to say, "But the president's tax panel said blankety blankety blank about the fair tax." To avoid any confusion, then, we wanted to devote a moment's attention to the ninth chapter. To our reading, the panel's ninth chapter seems out of place, coming as the final chapter in a long report of rigorous comparisons and economic insights. Chapter 9 is devoid of both. In their place, we find political commentary and a string of statements of the obvious. It's as though the panel simply ran out of steam before it reached Chapter 9, but felt compelled to cobble together a list of reasons why it did not choose to recommend a true consumption tax, such as a sales tax. And compelled it was, since throughout its 11-month process, the panel was inundated with words, letters, and emails from fair tax supporters and volunteers. As far as we can tell, the fair tax dominated the public's comments to the panel. That's a moot point now. That public support is still on the public record. You can find it at the tax panel's website, taxreformpanel.gov. in the public comment section. In fact, all the tax panel information is posted on the website. So if you read something here that you'd like to explore further, that site is a good resource for everything that happened between the executive order in January 2005 and the report in November of 2007. For all of you whose heart rates peaked while reading our book, we recommend the tax panel report to you. In parts, it's really a page-turner. If you do read it, we think you'll find what we found. It begins strong, a host of insights about reform. It finishes weak with a series of cursory overviews and dismissals of alternatives to the panel's proposals. We'll get to the negatives in a moment, though. First, the positives. Chapter 1, Positive Case for Reform, citing many of the facts and statistics you've heard us use. The panel talks about complexity, noting that Americans pay an extra $1 billion in taxes every year simply because they don't itemize, and that 60% of Americans must now pay a professional to do their taxes. It talks about compliance costs, noting what the amount of money that Americans spend filling out their tax forms would fund, and we quote, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of State, NASA, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Transportation, the United States Congress, our federal courts, and all the federal government's foreign aid. Wow! Talk about some wasted money. The panel points out the epidemic of noncompliance created by the current tax code and what it cost each honest taxpayer, about $2,000 a year in extra taxes. It looks at the arbitrariness of our tax code, noting that increasing your income by 50% can increase your tax burden by 140%. Chapter 1 offers charts to show that marginal income tax rates in the current code can rise to more than 30% for a family with an income of just $30,000 a year. That's 30% in addition to the 15% payroll tax burden, a 45% marginal rate on a $30,000 income. Tell us again why working America should prefer the current system to the 23% fair tax. Chapter 2, there's your thorough history of the income tax code, from a picture of one of the very first tax forms to a chart depicting the more than 16,000 changes to the income tax code since 1986. The panel covers the topic very well. It must be noted that there is not a single reference here in these pages to the payroll tax, the largest tax Americans pay, and a tax that collects almost as much and occasionally more from working Americans than the personal income tax does. We understand that the panel considered it outside of its charge. Are you hearing this? With more than 80% of Americans losing more of their paycheck to payroll taxes than income taxes, the tax reform panel couldn't even address payroll taxes. That's why they couldn't give an honest treatment to the fair tax. Thank goodness the fair tax does consider payroll taxes. Chapter 3 does a good job of explaining tax basics, things like different tax bases, the definition of tax incidence. Doesn't that sound sexy? Chapters 4, 5, and 6, and Chapter 7 discuss the two reform models that the tax panel proposed and how it arrived at them. We won't go into detail on those here because, as we said, apparently they've been forgotten by the administration. And while the panel did the best it could within the very limited status quo latitude the president gave it, the two proposals didn't come anywhere close to the breadth of reform that we fair tax supporters are demanding. Again, if you want to read the panel's proposals, any of the chapters we discussed, or simply the panel's report in its entirety, your address is taxreformpanel.gov. Knock yourselves out. Don't you think our describing the tax panel recommendations generously as tinkering and status quo is just sour grapes because we didn't get our way? Our view was echoed by commentators like Robert Novak in the Chicago Sun-Times. He said, 10 months and the tax panel has zero to show. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay described the recommendations as too small, and at bottom they only simplify and slightly improve a broken system. The Investment News agreed. They said tax reform plans seem too tame. If you need a good laugh, though, you should take a look at a few of the headlines that appeared after the tax panel's report was released. From the sounds of its opponents, those with a vested interest in the current system who opposed even the relatively minor changes proposed by the panel, the sky was falling and all was lost. California Treasurer Phil Angelides, the tax plan that cheats California, the National Association of Realtors, all homeowners will suffer if this policy is enacted. Nancy Pelosi, the president's tax reform panel would demolish the building blocks middle-class Americans use to reach the American dream. A Newswire, Life Insurance Agents Group warns that tax changes could spell doom for industry. All this commotion over proposals that we and others called minor. Now remember this as you read any criticisms of the fair tax. If the special interests use words like cheat and suffer and demolish and doom to describe the tax panel's report, you better put on a seatbelt before you read their comments about the fair tax. It's in Chapter 9 of the report that the panel addresses the question of why it failed to recommend a national retail sales tax. Keep in mind that the panel mentions the fair tax only 3 times in the entire report. Chapter 9 is hardly an attack on the fair tax. On the contrary, it's an effort to discredit the general idea of a national sales tax. Why the panel chose to pursue that course, still a mystery. But the biased conclusions of the final chapter are a strange contrast to the good work in the rest of the report. Chapter 9 opens by stating that the panel rejected the idea of a sales tax for 2 reasons. First, replacing the income tax with a sales tax that doesn't have a prebate would shift the tax burden toward the middle and lower income Americans and thus would not be appropriately progressive as mandated by the president. Second, including a prebate would inappropriately increase the size and scope of government. We'll address that again in a moment. The first objection that a sales tax without a prebate is unfair to lower-income Americans recurs throughout Chapter 9. We probably agree with that sentiment, but we don't know of anybody anywhere in the nation who is proposing such a thing. So congratulations to the tax panel for taking a strong stand against something that nobody is even proposing. That's government for you. The second objection is the first of a string of flat-out odd statements that seem to be thrown into Chapter 9 that claim that abolishing the income tax would inappropriately increase the size and scope of government. How strange that the panel tasked with reforming the income tax, the most intrusive, powerful, and despised of all American institutions, chose to preserve the income tax because the proposal supported by me and Linder and the rest of you would create too much government. This was flabbergasting. Neither of us can remember ever being accused of supporting big government, period. If the thought wasn't so crazy, it would have hurt our feelings. Now, as we've said, the prebate is the toughest part of the fair tax to get your mind and emotions around, and we're constantly looking for ways to improve it. Our beef with the tax panel isn't that the prebate isn't a cause for concern. Our beef with the tax panel is that the prebate isn't a reason to give up tax reform. It just seems like an excuse for the panel to say no. Still think we're paranoid? Here's another odd quote. As you know, the fair tax is premised on an extremely large tax base. This is part of its fundamental intent. The larger the base, the lower the tax rate can be. The lower the rate, the less intrusive. In Chapter 3, the tax panel does a good job of explaining why large tax bases are good and small tax bases are bad. Yet in Chapter 9, after noting the large base of the fair tax, the panel goes on to explain why that base might shrink over time due to legislative changes. In other words, beware of the fair tax. It might be changed in the future. On what level does that make sense? There's no warning elsewhere in the report that either of the tax panel's proposals will be just as vulnerable to change by a future Congress. There's no warning that a VAT could be changed by a future Congress. But a number of pages in Chapter 9 sound the ominous warning that someday somebody might try to change the rules of a national sales tax. Can't we just agree that all taxes are subject to change and the voter must stand up and say yes or no? Come on, that's American Government 101. The strangely cobbled together pages of Chapter 9 also include this shocking revelation. Quote, moreover, unless the states repealed their existing sales taxes, most consumers would pay both federal and state sales taxes on many goods. Shocking, isn't it? Well, in case you weren't shocked, the tax panel threw in a big number to tell you how much that combined state and federal sales tax might be. The fair tax rate is a big number, and when you combine it with state sales tax rates, the number gets even bigger. But it's important to remember two things. First, it's exactly what we're all collectively paying today. Second, the same very big scary math applies to the income tax, in which states collect an additional income tax on what we pay the feds. Did you catch the section of the report that clarifies that you'll need to pay state income taxes on top of the income taxes it proposes? No, probably didn't. It's not there. Did you catch that spot where it highlights the really big rate that represents the combined federal and state income taxes you'd pay? Nope, it's not there. We're talking about federal taxes. And of course, the state tax situation, that will still be out there. It will exist. We still can't figure out why the panel felt the need to bring them up at all, and then only in the context of the sales tax. You still think we're crazy? We have dozens more examples, but we'll just include one more. On page 220 of the report, you'll find a section concerning state sales taxes. It's unlikely that states would model their state sales tax on the federal tax, the report says, because states would fail to follow the federal model and confusion and pandemonium would ensue. That's on page 220. Then turn to page 221. Here you find a section talking about state income taxes. The panel worries about removing the federal income tax because most states have modeled their income tax on it. Because states would no longer use the federal model, confusion and pandemonium would ensue. Thus saith page 221. We're certain there's a grain of truth in both pages, but can the tax panel really fault the national sales tax for both? If states love following a federal model, as page 221 suggests, they'll be pleased to have the federal sales tax to follow. If states hate following a federal model, as page 220 suggests, they'll be pleased to get rid of the federal income tax so they can do their own thing. We don't claim to know which one is true, but isn't it a little strange for the tax panel to use both of those two concerns, complete opposites, as reasons to oppose a federal sales tax? And yes, you guessed it. None of the other chapters says a word about the angst that the tax panel's own proposals might cause the states that have come to rely on the federal model. Nor is there any discussion of the money that states lose annually in sales taxes and how many are requesting a federal system for coordinating catalog and internet sales. Shocking. So when you read Chapter 9 of the panel's report, or more important, when you hear somebody citing the tax panel to attack the fair tax, keep all of this in mind. We don't know why this chapter is so bizarre, but we think you see what we mean. Oh, you remember that we said the fair tax got three mentions in the panel's report? The first was the reference to its large base. The second was for the prebate system. The third, a little box on page 217 of the report, a note suggesting that the fair tax rate was wrong. And how did the panel come to that conclusion? Well, we've asked that question, but the fair tax panel declined to share its math with us. And our request for backup through the Freedom of Information Act is still working its way through the process. We're not worried, though. As you might imagine, when the fair tax was created, we had no idea what the rate would be. The good folks at Americans for Fair Taxation had to hire some of the top economic minds in the country to tell us the proper rate. The AFFT received three calculations of the rate from three leading national economists and were rather comforted by the fact that one of these three economists was none other than tax panel member Dr. James Poterba. The rate he recommended, 23.1%. So we're not going to quibble over that 0.1%. This recording was produced and directed by Christina Michelle Gonzalez. It was recorded at WSB Radio in Atlanta, Georgia by Neil Bortz, edited by Lance Neal, the mixing and mastering by Lance Neal.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life? And select from one of the many available children's audiobooks.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, you can log on to harperaudio.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.